This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. On the opening page of Kwame Alexander's beautifully written new memoir, he writes, "My mother died on September 1st, 2017. Within a month, the cracks in my marriage emerged. They would eventually become impassable canyons. Within 2 years, our eldest would pack her belongings, clothes, books, heart, and leave home, and leave us. Overnight, I was barefoot on Mount Everest." Unquote. We also learn on the first page that by the time he was two, he was dressed in a dashiki. His father was a Baptist preacher of black liberation theology who assigned books to Alexander and then quizzed him on them, which made Alexander hate books until he later found the books he loved. His mother was an educator who became a principal. Kwame Alexander's new memoir is called Why Fathers Cry at Night, and it's told in the form of prose, poems, letters, and recipes. It's his first book for adults. He's best known for his children's books, which include The Undefeated, for which he won a Caldecott Medal. His Newbery Medal-winning book, The Crossover, has been adapted into a Disney Plus series, on which he serves as an executive producer and writer. When we spoke, I had a cold, and my voice was hoarse, but I didn't want to miss doing this interview. I recorded my end from home.
Kwame Alexander, welcome to Fresh Air. Forgive my voice, I have a remainder of a cold. So your wonderful book started as a book of love poems, but turned into a book that's also about the end of love, the end of marriage, a troubled relationship with your father, and troubles with your daughters. I want you to start by reading the opening paragraph from very early in the book, page 7, from a chapter titled A Letter to My Daughters. And much of this book is written to your daughters. Would you read that first paragraph?
Ever since I was a child and discovered his framed marriage counselor accreditation certificate tucked inside a sexual intimacy and marriage manual in our garage, I have wanted to speak to my father about marriage. Now, as an adult, I wonder, did he and my mother ever hold hands? How did he court her? Did he dance with her and then help her with the dishes? Did he make love to her in the kitchen? Did she rub his scalp after? How did they love is the question I've contemplated asking during those times when my own love life was discomforting or in peril. I've wanted to know more about the woman he had a child with, the woman who was not my mother, his wife. I've wanted to ask him, did he love her too? When my mother, fed up, finally moved out, was their marriage better? Did she date? Did he? Why didn't they ever divorce? As I stand on the ledge of the unraveling of my own coupling, I have so many questions for the man who made me, but I'm too afraid to ask.
That's a very heavy way to start. Now that you've asked those questions in your book, which your father can read, has he answered any of your questions?
Wow, has he answered them? My father and I have, you know, had a father-son relationship, naturally, for 54 years. We had our first man-to-man conversation about 3 months ago after he had read the book. And it was just two dudes, two guys, two men talking about the woes and wonders of romance. And it was a beautiful thing for me. And no, he hasn't necessarily answered any of the questions, but I feel like a door has been opened. So if those questions are going to be asked, I have a way in now, and perhaps he has a way into answering some of them.
I want to ask you about books, because you write in your book that your parents used books as both reward and punishment. Your father was a Baptist preacher. He preached black liberation theology. He had his own small publishing company, sold his books in the churches where he preached, held an annual book fair. He also taught college, I think. Your mother was a teacher and became a principal. What were some of the ways that books were both reward and punishment when you were growing up?
Oh, well, you know, as a young child, as a, you know, as an elementary and a middle school student, you know, I used the word forced. And my father, he sort of shakes his head when I use that word. But in my remembrance, I was forced to read books that I didn't necessarily want to read, whether it be the Funkin' Wagnalls Encyclopedia or his dissertations from Teachers College, Columbia University. Like, no books any 11-year-old should have to read. And I would rather have been playing Atari or hanging out with my friends. And so in my eyes, that was a punishment. Why should I have to do that? Why should I have to work for my father's publishing company as a 12-year-old and lick stamps to put on envelopes that house catalogs for the books that he published? Why did I have to sell books behind a table at a trade show? Why couldn't I just be like a regular kid? You know, on the flip side, my mother was the one who introduced me to Lucille Clifton and Nikki Giovanni and Dr. Seuss and made words fun and cool and interesting. And we loved to hear her tell stories. She loved telling us African folktales. And so you had these sort of two sides happening in my home where books were cool and books were staid and incomprehensible and uninteresting.
You know, by writing this book, you opened the door to a conversation you never had before with your father.
I did. And I remember the exact moment where I was able to sort of glean that, okay, we're going to have a relationship that is meaningful and significant. Like, I can see where in the past I could not see how we were going to be father and son and go to the baseball game and play ping pong and live the kind of life where you feel good about this bond, this familial bond you have with your parent. Like, I never saw how that was going to be possible outside of words. And then one day in 2015, I won this award called the Newbery Medal. And Terry, prior to that, maybe my father and I had talked. We had cool conversations once every 3 weeks or a month. After I won the Newbery Medal, we began to have a conversation every day for about an hour. And that was 8 years ago. And we literally talk all the time. And it's real talk. And I understand that, you know, my father loves through words. He loves through books. And I had achieved this thing that symbolized and represented all that he cares about.
Yeah, it's wonderful that you've, you know, opened that door. At the same time, you shouldn't have had to do it. You know, like, you shouldn't have to prove that you're a terrific writer in order to have a close relationship with your father. He's not your teacher. He's not grading you.
I don't know, Terry. That's the thing. I think I felt like that. I've used those exact same words for so many years. But one of the things writing this book has taught me is to extend a little bit of grace, is to realize that my father loved me in the way that he knew how to love me, or in the way that he chose to love me. It may not have been in the way I chose or wanted him to love me. And I thought about that as I began to think about my daughters who are going to read this book. And I think one of the reasons why I wrote it is so that they can put some context about how their dad loved. And it may not have been how they wanted him to love, how they wanted me to love, but I loved them and I cared about them in my way. And here's some of the reasons why, and here's some of the evidence. So I try to extend a little bit of grace to him, and I feel okay with it.
Your new memoir started as a book of love poems, and your love poems are great, but I especially like some of the poems about the end of relationships. And I'd like you to read an excerpt of one of those now. The poem is called Love Story.
Yeah, so this piece is sort of an amalgamation of several different relationships that I've had over the years in college and beyond, and me just being in love with love and trying to understand, you know, how love ends and why it ends, and not ever really fully grasping any of that. 5. After he introduced her to Nancy Wilson and Cannonball Adderley, she taught him the secret to a good omelet: chili powder. They overslept regularly, skipping classes, reading to each other, planning a future. The way she woke him each day was epic and electric. 6. And 5 years later, it is over, just like that. She holds his hands to her chest, tells him that she is still a word woman, that first and foremost, she will always love the way he colors her, line by line, word by binding word, but that metaphors cannot pay the mortgage, that there are no stock options for literary photographers of passion and pain, that dentists don't accept concise wordplay as payment, that all the beautiful music in the world don't mean a thing if we don't have a vehicle to carry the hopes and dreams in our heart. 7. The next day, when he watches her drive away in the two-door metallic gift to the sound of a runner stealing home in the 9th inning, he knows the masquerade is over. And so is love. And so is love.
I really, among other things, I love the way you reference music in your poems and recipes. And I thought this is a good moment to hear an excerpt of the Nancy Wilson Cannonball Adderley album that you referenced that has The Masquerade Is Over on it. It's a gorgeous track, although we don't really hear Cannonball Adderley on it. So I want to make sure that we hear the second verse that she sings, which is that your words don't mean what they used to mean. They were once inspired, now they're just routine. Yep. So here's Nancy Wilson.
Your words don't mean what they used to mean. They were once inspired, now they're just routine. I'm afraid the masquerade is over. And so is love. And so is love. I guess I'll have to play Pagliacci.
Did you reference that song in this poem because it's not only an incredibly beautiful track, but because it has those lines, your words don't mean what they used to mean. They were once inspired, now they're just routine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's so many, you know, crossovers in this piece, and reading it just reminds me that in college, I listened to hip hop and R&B, and I come home one spring break and I'm in my attic and I discover a crate of jazz records. And these jazz records belong to my father. And I know that because his name is stenciled at the top of the jazz records. And one of the records I borrow and take back to Virginia Tech is the Cannonball Adderley Nancy Wilson album. And I'm playing it nonstop. And I invite a woman over and I play it for her on my used record player. And I make her, you know, I cook for her. The food wasn't that great. You know, I was way out of my league with her, but this was sort of my way of trying to be cool and be and find and have her find me interesting. And we listened to the jazz and we ate the food and we kissed. And 2 years later, you know, she married me. And 4 years after that, you know, the thing about writing a memoir is, damn, you are saying all of your stuff. You're putting it out there. And this is really challenging because I've always been that person who hasn't opened up, who hasn't shared. But we're here now. So 4 years later, we're married and she's about to get up to go to work. And, you know, I'm a poet. I've written my first book. I'm not making any money. My books aren't selling. Nobody knows who I am. But I'm loving this life of being a writer. But I forgot something. I forgot to pay the car note. And so she wakes up to go to work and the car is gone. It's been repossessed. And that was the day, you know, her mom took her to work. And when she got off work, we had a talk and she said, it's over. Poetry isn't going to pay the bills. I love the fact that you want to be a poet, but it's not going to work for this family. You have a daughter. You have a wife. And so this poem, it comes out of that sadness that I was, you know, I played a significant role in that happening. So, you know, there's so many different things, the jazz, my dad's records, Pam, marriage, love, and trying to figure out how to make a life out of words when they're not serving you.
Did you think about giving up writing as a profession when that happened?
Never. And that's the sad. That, I don't know if it's sad.
It's not sad. You've been incredibly successful. One of your books has turned into a Disney Plus series. You're an executive producer of it and a writer.
And, you know, that's the rub, Terry, is that all of these things, you know, were happening in my career. And it's just been hugely successful, as it were. But I couldn't sleep. And I found myself just not being engaged with life in a real happy way. And I had to stop and say, well, what's going on? Everything's going right. But you don't feel that like you should. And when is that going to change?
Has it changed?
Oh, it's definitely been writing this book has been so eye-opening and awakening for me, because it has allowed me to begin to see the things that have not served me. You know, I can acknowledge them. I can understand them. Now, that is not the end of the work, because that really is just the beginning. So I've then had to sort of begin to put in the work to bring into fruition all these things that I now know about myself and that I'm still learning about myself. So I think and I hope that it is working.
We've talked about your life as a son. I want to talk about your life as a father. You write that you learned how to father from men who failed miserably. Do you want to explain what you mean, or would you rather read that section from the book?
I'd love to read it.
Go ahead.
I also learned how to father from men who failed miserably. The friend of my father's who got into a violent argument with his wife in my grandmother's driveway and, upon being chased by a knife-wielding woman, proceeded to lift his 7-year-old daughter, my best friend, in front of him as a shield. A college friend's father who'd been sentenced to prison for abusing troubled teenagers during his kids' sleepovers. An old girlfriend's father who lived around the corner her entire childhood and never once came over to see her, who never invited her to his house, who refused to acknowledge her even when she walked past his house, a monsoon of heartbreak forming behind her juvenile eyes. I wasn't any of these men, and I would never be. But I carried the weight of their failures with my own insecurities as a father.
How did you try to counter that as a father?
Well, I tried to be there. I tried to be there with my daughters in a really present way. And again, you know, not knowing how good or bad I'm doing, just doing it, just doing the work of being a father. And of course, you know, looking back on how I've been as a father and who I've been as a father, man, I've made so many mistakes. My youngest daughter, you know, she doesn't necessarily like us or like me coming to her athletic games. And I'm like, why? No, I just don't want you to come. And part of me understands that reason, even if she can't articulate it, that when she was six, she played on a basketball team and she was She was the tallest person on the court because I'm 6'4", so of course she's pretty tall. And she asked to be taken out of the fourth quarter because she was tired. And I remember going to the bench and saying, "You need to get back in that game. What are you doing? Why are you?" And she's like, "I'm tired." I was like, "I know, but they need you." And I remember her going out and running up and down the court, really lackluster. And her team, they happened to win. And after the game, she was so excited. And I remember going up to her and saying, "I don't know why you're excited. You know, you didn't give your all. You need to be out there. If you're on the court, play with energy." And I just went, I lit into her, and she just cried. And Steph came over and, you know, sort of hugged her and gave me a look and took her. And she went to ballet or violin practice, and I never thought anything about it. And the next week, she played her butt off and made the All-Star team, and I felt like the best father in the world. But I haven't been able to go to any of her games because she doesn't want me to come now, and she's 14 years old. So I failed, man. I failed in my own ways. And again, I think two things. I'm trying to learn from that. I'm trying to learn from that so I can be better now. And I'm 54 years old, and my hope is that it's not too late. And that I also hope that these two girls, these two daughters, Nandi and Samaya, will extend a little bit of grace to me that I realize I need to extend to my own father.
At the time you wrote the book, you were not communicating, or rather I should say your eldest daughter was not communicating with you. And can I ask you to read the few lines about that toward the end of your book?
The other daughter, who came to live with me at 15, a quiet, consistently kind, altruistic, reliable, and industrious woman, told me in the middle of a familial disagreement, one of only a few heated arguments we've ever had, that she would never speak to me again. It's been 3 years, and she is immovable. At night, I sit in the dark, in the space between hope and heart, the grief stealing warmth, trying to remember how to love, trying to figure out the right words to bring you both back to me.
Have things resolved? I was hoping maybe they had in the time between the book was written and now.
She sent an email to one of the folks on my team, and she said that she had heard that the book was out. And this was when it was an advanced reading copy before it hit the shelves. She'd heard that it was out, and she wanted to know if she could read it because she wanted to prepare herself and her mother in case I talked about them in a way that might be embarrassing or revealing their private life. Basically, if I was going to put her stuff out there in the world to tell her business. And I just, that hurt my heart so much because A, I would never do that. That's the first thing. And the second thing, that she was feeling that kind of, you know, that heartache, it just, the father in me just, and I couldn't do anything to help, to, it just, it hurt. And so I sent her the book with a note, and about a month later, because there's nothing in the book that's going to embarrass her or make her feel less than or put her business out there. Like I love her dearly. And a month later, she emailed me. And she said, I'm ready to talk. Please send me some dates and times you're available. And the thing that just got me, that made me smile, that made me see that there's some hope here, is the way she signed it. She said, thank you, comma, dad. And that meant everything.
So at the end of your book, you know, your marriage has broken up. your mother has died, your older daughter had stopped communicating with you, and this all happened within a short period of time. How has all of that changed you? All of that happening at the same time and kind of leaving you alone in a way that you hadn't been during your adult life?
Yeah, it's left me in this space of realizing that I am not a grown man, I'm a growing man. It's left me feeling renewed at the possibility of having the kind of life that I would have never thought possible since this book has been written. I have spent time with my three siblings in a way that we haven't spent time together since we were living in my parents' house together. I've had conversations with my father that I never would have thought I had. I have been honest and forthcoming in a way that has been painfully hard. And I have felt so good. I've been able to sleep at night. I've been able to walk through life and feel a lot better about who I am and who I am becoming as a man. And so, you know, I have built this beautiful writerly career, and I have strategized and planned and enacted. And now I am going to spend, you know, a great deal of time doing the same thing in my personal life so that I can have, you know, the most fruitful and uplifting and interesting, you know, relationships with the people I love and who love me.
Well, I think this is a really nice note to end on. Congratulations on the book and all the good changes it's brought in your life. It's really been a pleasure talking with you and such a pleasure to have read your book. Thank you, Kwame.
I'm so honored and your thoughtful and kind questions, and I just really appreciate it. Thank you so much, Terry.
Kwame Alexander's new memoir is called Why Fathers Cry at Night. We recorded it last month when I had a cold, which is why my voice was hoarse. Our next guest, Lydia Bastianich, is a celebrity chef famous for her Italian recipes. She has a long-running PBS series, Lydia's Kitchen. She's written over 15 cookbooks, has owned several restaurants, and has won multiple James Beard Awards. Her family lived on the Italian peninsula Istria. As a child, she learned a lot about cooking from her grandmother, who was poor and cooked over a wood fire. During the periods she lived with her grandmother, all of the ingredients were from her grandmother's garden or from the livestock her grandparents raised, including 2 pigs a year. But after World War II, the peninsula changed hands from Italy to communist Yugoslavia. Bastianich's parents were followed by secret police, and her father was arrested. Her family managed to flee after the border closed, and for a couple of years they lived in a refugee camp in Italy that was a former Nazi concentration camp. Then her family emigrated to the U.S. Her show, Lydia's Kitchen, returns for its 11th season in October. I spoke with Bastianich last month at a WHYY event at which she was presented with WHYY's Lifelong Learning Award. So you grew up in Istria, which is a peninsula kind of parallel to Italy. The northwestern tip is attached to Italy, and the northeastern tip is attached to Croatia. Mm-hmm. The year you were born in 1947, that was the year that the peninsula that you lived on switched hands from Italy to Yugoslavia, which was communist. So your mother was pregnant with you at the time. A lot of their friends fled Istria because they didn't want to live in a communist country. But because your mother was pregnant, your father said, you're not going to give birth in a refugee camp, so we're staying. When you look back at that time and think about what a consequential decision your parents had to make while your mother was pregnant with you, what do you think about when you reflect on that?
You know, Terry, when I reflect on my life, I'm grateful. I had a wonderful life. I have it, a wonderful family. So I cannot regret anything that happened. If anything, in that period maybe of having a hard time and difficulties and not being able to speak your native language, not being able to respect your religion and go to church and all of that, at the time it would seem very oppressive. And it is.
And then you ended up moving to a refugee camp, which was actually, it was called San Saba.
San Saba, yes.
San Saba. And it was basically a former concentration camp during World War II. Mm-hmm. There's a picture of it in your memoir. Doesn't look good.
No, it's still...
Describe what the atmosphere was like there. I think you didn't know at the time that it had been a concentration camp, but... You know, there was a crematorium there, too. There were the ovens. So, like, what was the feeling? Did it feel haunted even though you didn't know what had gone on there?
Yes, there was a feeling of darkness. There was a smell. There was, you know...
What was the smell?
It was musty, mud. Because also the courtyard, you know, it was enclosed. Everything was enclosed. They had this big gate, and you couldn't pass. Now, just to explain how we got there, when we came and my father met us, we didn't have the papers. We didn't have complete papers. So had we remained in Italy, we could have asked for Italian refuge, but my parents decided even Italy was in conditions after the war, let's try and go on to America or Canada, whatever. So we were there without papers, and had the police, because the Yugoslavs had secret police in Trieste.
Oh.
So, and they kind of would spot people that escaped, you know, because they're kind of look lost, and they would repatriate them. You know, they would bring them to the guards and say, listen, to the police, they don't have any papers. These need to go back. So my parents immediately decided to go to the police and ask for asylum. And at that point, if you ask for asylum, you're an immigrant without papers, and they put us in the camp. And then there, it's controlled. You can't leave, you can't go out, you have to stay within those boundaries. And it was closed. It was closed, it had one main entrance, and it was like a big courtyard, and there was dirt on it. So when it rained and all that, was really, really muddy. And the rooms, we had little cubby halls, and they were separated by no wall, but cardboard paper, boards, even some with cloth. That was the separation. So you heard everybody. We had two beds, what do you call them, on top of each other?
Bunk beds.
Two bunk beds. Yeah. Yeah, one for the kids and the other side, my parents. And we stayed there until we began the process of vetting and beginning to file our papers.
You had a lot of trauma as a child, whether you recognized it as trauma or not. And I'm wondering what the relationship in your life has been between food and trauma. Because one way of trying to soothe yourself when you're suffering through a trauma or reliving the trauma is to eat, or to eat comfort foods, foods that you love. Of course, at the time, food wasn't plentiful for you. It was scarce. So what do you think in the long term, like, your relationship between food and trauma has been?
My relationship, definite realization, what food meant to me was when we were in Trieste, in Italy, in the camp, and I did not know that we were not going to go back to grandma. And so that feeling of unfinished work, I hadn't said goodbye to my grandmother, to my friends, but when I realized that I wasn't going back, food became my connector. When my aunt would cook the food, the smells, it brought me back to my grandmother, to that place. And I realized that I could do that to satisfy myself. And then I realized that, you know, I was pretty good at it. And then I realized that I could nurture and feed other people. And I loved that, just like my grandmother did. And so on, my life became exactly that, a life of cooking and nurturing from family to people, and ultimately the opportunity of turning it all into a business.
So when you were in the former concentration camp, at some point you were allowed out to go to a convent school. You had come from the peninsula where basically religion had been banned. So you started to learn about Catholicism, and you also worked in the kitchen there, and that you've described that as your introduction to commercial cooking. Mm-hmm. What's one or two of the things that you learned that you later were able to apply to restaurants?
Well, how did I get to go to the school? There was a family, actually, Signora Leonori. She was a wonderful woman. She had three sons, and one of them was autistic. And she was looking for somebody to help her son, and she went to the camp, and my mother was an elementary school teacher, and of course, the Italian, we spoke Italian. So she asked her if she would come on a regular basis, and that she would pay a little bit to her, but also that she would pay her schooling. So, you know, they gave her the permit to go, and she would go every day, bring me to the convent. The convent was right next door to Mrs. Leonori's house. And I guess, I don't know how much she contributed to my education, but the nuns also, I guess, felt that maybe I should help out a little bit to make up for my... So I was in the kitchen. In the morning when I came early with my mother, they would put me there, peel the apples, peel the potatoes, whatever. And then the first time that I saw those big pots and, you know, really sort of institutional cooking, because they had... the school was there, and they would cook a meal for the children every day. I enjoyed it. But also, you know, the religion was there. Grandma tried her best to take me. So I was a little bit... But it always revived when I went to that convent, my commitment and understanding who I am and my culture.
So you came to America when you were 12. You met your future husband at your own Sweet 16.
Yes.
And he was also, he was from the same peninsula, right?
He was. He was from the other side of the peninsula, yes.
Yeah. And you got married like midway through college.
Yes.
And you left college because you also got pregnant soon after you were married. And, of course, your mother was very upset. She wanted you to finish college.
She was very upset.
Yeah. And your son, after being... when he was 18 months old, he was diagnosed with a kind of blood bone disease.
No, with Perthes. Perthes disease is a bone disease, and it is in developing infants in the hip joint, the round part. It doesn't get enough nourishment, and if they walk, they consume it, and ultimately club foot sets in.
So he had to stop walking for a year. So just when children are really like learning to walk, he couldn't walk. He was in a brace.
He had a brace. He
like
had
18 months.
Yeah, had to keep his legs so that the bone would get the nourishment.
And this is about the same time that you and your husband are starting your first restaurant, right?
Just after we were planning, but just after that, yes, we opened our first restaurant.
What was it like for you as a mother of a son who needed a lot of attention? I'm sure you were very worried about him, to also be having this new undertaking with your husband, and you were needed at the restaurant, and you were needed at home.
Well, it's hard for a mother to hear that a child, no matter, you know, what the illness is. So the fact of assessing that and understanding that it eventually could be cured, that sort of alleviates you because you're part of the solution. So keeping him in a brace with metal bars in front of it, and it had this what is this thing that sticks that you can stick it? They use it on everything.
Velcro.
Velcro. So they were with Velcro. So of course this young kid, he was 2.5. Zoom, zoom, he would pull up, and he would start running, and I would run after him, put him back into this braces. So it was a tough time, but. Again, I consider myself blessed in the sense that I had my mother and my father. We always kind of, by now we had nobody else. We lived together in the sense. My first few years, a year or something of marriage, of course you need your independence. But as soon as Joe came and all that, they moved in. And they were downstairs, and you know, the typical setting of a mother and daughter.
So that's who they helped raise your son.
Yes, yeah, they were there. I couldn't have done what I did without the support, certainly, of my family, of my mother, of everybody around. But when I first had my daughter, of course, I took 2 or 3 months off, and then it was time that really I needed to go back. I needed to, and I was kind of questioning myself. So I went to the pediatrician. You know, we had no psychiatrist at that time. At least we didn't go to psychiatrists. So we went I went to the doctor and I said, yeah, I told him that I feel, you know, I don't know what to do. I have this child. I'm the mother. I'm responsible. I want to be with her. And yet, you know, the business, unless I help my husband with the business and all that, we might not be able to do a lot of things. And he was very wise. He said, Lydia, children are happy within the family. They understand. Children come into a family. You don't change the family because children come into it, which happens a lot of times. So that said, okay, our priorities were we had to work to feed and whatever. He said, children want happy parents. You know, I said, okay, I can live with that. And so it happened. I managed with my mother. I gave my kids the best time. I included them as much as I could when I was doing. I was bringing them to the restaurant as much. They had the dinner. They had their time. The weekends, Mondays was the day off because we would always do special things with them. And they were happy. And I think that's why my children are back running the business, even though I told them that this is not what they should do when they grow up. You should get an education and go on. They're back into it.
What was on your first menu in your first restaurant?
Oh, it was all Italian-American because, you know, in 71, all the famous restaurants were Italian-American. And certainly the chef that we hired was Italian-American. And then once I went into the kitchen, then I began to kind of modify and add polenta, add risotto, and that's where sort of I made my space.
But you started off with the larger meatballs.
Absolutely. The larger, the better.
Your mother died in 2021 during COVID. Was it COVID related?
No. She died of a heart condition. She was 100 in January and died in February.
Wow.
So, you know, as much as still to this day, because she always lived with me, I'm grateful I had, you know, I didn't have her for all 100 years, but I had her until her 100th year.
Your father died, was it in 1970 or something?
71.
Yeah. Mm. And so he didn't live.
81.
He didn't live to see how successful you became as a chef, as a restaurant owner, as a TV personality. He didn't live to see that, but your mother did. You must be so grateful that she lived to see that and to know that the choices that they made worked out so well in the long run.
Well, you know, going back to the moment of being an immigrant and coming, there were a few times that, you know, I caught my mother, my father. You kind of, you know, parents whisper, they think the kids don't hear, you know, did we do the right thing? Or maybe we shouldn't. Is this going to be okay for the kids? And I always felt, and my brother as well, you know, that we wanted to show them that the decision was absolutely right. They couldn't have done a better thing, and I kept on telling her. But also, she was very much part of this success. And again, if you see my shows, she was in the house. My kids were in the house. So this was real. I didn't have a scripted show. I don't have script. I ad-lib. I speak. We create a menu. We create talking points, and then I'm there. So my shows are quite open and real and with some preparation. And my mother was always part. Now, for those of you that still watch the shows, my mother, even after she passed, I just couldn't leave her off the shows. And at the end, we end the show with her singing some songs. And we're going to do the same. It's to honor her because she was such a big part.
Yeah. I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. I want to thank you for your recipes, for your TV show, and also just for your strength.
Thank you, Terry.
So I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lydia Bastianich is the host of the long-running PBS series Lydia's Kitchen. It returns for its 11th season in October. Her new cookbook will be published in September. We spoke last month at a WHYY event at which Bastianich was honored with WHYY's Lifelong Learning Award. Our thanks to Ellen Steele and Tina Kalecki. Here's Lydia with her late mother, Erminia.
Okay, you're going to sing for us.
Do you want me to sing?
Whatever you like.
Bevevano i nostri padri.
Sì.
Take a glass. Bevevano le nostre madri.
Sì.
E noi che figli siamo, beviamo, beviamo, beviamo. E noi che figli siamo, beviamo, beviamo, beviamo.
Salute.
Salute.
Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Fresh Air's co-host is Tanya Mosley. I'm Terry Gross.